welcome to the Raging Bull Podcast. I'm your host, Ben Sturgill. Join me as I interview people from all walks of life who've built successful lives, self-made millionaires, entrepreneurs, traders, authors, and experts in their chosen fields. Discover the mindset and motivation to make successful people tick and learn new ways to apply these ideas, lessons, and successes to help you build your own success and live a better life.
Gene Chatsky, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Just reading your bio and understanding all you've done, it just feels like you've had so much exposure to so many things, so many people, and so many ideas. But, you know, as we do on the WealthWise podcast, we'd really love to just dig into your story about how you kind of have come to this place of recognizing the value and importance of having understanding, knowledge around money in order, you know, I think you wrote, to own your life, you have to own your money and you have to know about that. I love that thought. And so I would just love to know kind of more about where that started for you.
Sure. So I grew up in the Midwest. We moved around a lot. My father was a college professor. My mom dipped in and out of the workforce. She was actually fairly amazing. She went back and got her master's when I was in junior high school and ended up doing everything from running a gifted and talented program for high school students to teaching college statistics. But professor salaries are not enormous. And I definitely, from my parents, learned early on the value of money, but also that the value of work. I was out babysitting from the time I was 11 years old, worked all the way through high school and college, and still managed when I graduated from college to make pretty much every typical financial mistake that you hear people making, from credit card debt to overspending to pulling money out of a 401k to not negotiating well for the next raise. Chances are pretty good that if it is on the list of the biggest money mistakes people make, I did it at one time or another. And I think I was attracted to this field in part because I wanted to fix my own life, and in part because I knew that it was out of control. And I very much believe that if you are in control of your money, then you are steering the ship rather than the other way around.
I think that idea is huge, Gene, to be able to understand, as one person said to me, Chris Hogan, you know, does your future just happen to you or do you happen to your future? That idea of control and controlling the outcomes based on what is controllable. And so, you know, what I want to know is for you as a child to kind of build up to that philosophy that you've held, do you feel like your idea around money or your interest in going to that field came more of as a result from kind of just your personality, or was it as a result of being a child of parents who didn't make, you know, all that much, as you've said, being a professor, and just realizing that, gosh, you know, if it's going to happen, I'm going to have to make it happen.
I actually think it came from my interest in math. I was a math geek in high school. I actually won the award my senior year for the best high school math student in my senior class.
Wow.
And then I went to college and I took calculus. I actually repeated calculus in college because I thought, okay, this is a good way to get my feet wet in the math department where I thought I might major. And I had a professor who spoke to the blackboard rather than to the students. I completely lost my way. I got the first C I've ever gotten in my life. I was devastated and I found my way to the school paper and started writing and reporting and pursuing journalism, which I really enjoyed and found that I was good at. And when I graduated from college, my goal was to, after having several jobs at magazines over summers, my goal was to get a job at a magazine. And I was fortunate in that the job I happened to get was as the assistant to the business editor at a magazine called Working Woman. Hmm. And Working Woman, it doesn't exist anymore, but it was a very strange amalgam of a magazine. There was beauty, there was fashion, there was food. And I was able to start writing some stories about business. And I had a boss who was very hot on the fact that if you added numbers to a business story, they would make your story stronger. And so I started doing that, and I think I found my way back to math in that way, that this comfort that I had originally had with numbers. And I was really interested in these business stories and career stories and marketing stories. And so when I left Working Woman, I actively pursued a job in business journalism. I couldn't get one because the business magazines that I was trying to apply to didn't think that Working Woman was a real magazine. Hmm. But I did eventually find my way to Wall Street because I thought about what we did every time we wrote business stories. And one of the things we did was to call an equity research analyst or two from a Wall Street firm to talk about the companies. And I had understood that the job that equity research analysts do is very similar to that of business journalists. And so I applied for a job in equity research, figuring that some research analyst might like to have me around to help write reports. And that job I was able to get, I was able to learn about financial statements and make my way back into business journalism.
Jean's work as a business journalist combined with her love and excellence in math started to coalesce. From there, her career path started to become more clearly defined as not only a reporter on business and financial topics, but increasingly about money and personal finance. But as other guests have explained, simply because you work in a specific field personally with money, wealth, and investing around you, it doesn't necessarily make it so in your own life. How did these threads come together for Jean? It's not just work, but something she began to apply and live in her own life.
It really happened over time. I was doing straightforward business journalism for a couple of years at Forbes magazine, and then I was recruited to join a new personal finance magazine called Smart Money, which was the child of the Hearst Magazine Corporation, mm-hmm. and Dow Jones. And I was able to, I went there as a writer and started reporting what I thought were really, really interesting stories on all sorts of aspects of personal finance. We were a startup, so we had a thin staff, so everybody wrote about everything. And as I started learning it, I started applying it. And then I started talking about it. So one of the things that happened along the way at Smart Money was that we had an active public relations effort. Mm. And the PR folks would pitch the magazine and stories from the magazine to various television outlets. So I ended up doing early morning TV in New York for about 3 years and then got picked up on the Today Show. And the more I learned about it, the more I wrote about it, the more I talked about it, the more I actually did it in my own life, the more under control I felt. And then when I got divorced at around age 40, I think it kicked my butt into an even higher gear.
One of the things we talk about often on the WealthWise podcast is a mindset toward building wealth, the mechanics of actually doing it, and the motivation, you know, when it happens. Would you say during that time that was more of a mindset change that shifted for you as you began to write about it and then talk about it? Or do you think it was a mindset and mechanics that kind of grew in terms of just your knowledge of actually how to manage the money that you had?
I think it was a little bit of both. I think mechanics came first. I think what followed shortly thereafter was, if I'm out there on a national stage or even a local New York City stage telling people to do stuff, I better be doing it too. Mm. And the mindset the big mindset change came when I turned 40, got divorced, and lost my dad within like a 6 month period.
Wow. That sounds like a significantly hard time. If I can ask, what do you feel like was that mindset change that happened in the midst of so much, turmoil?
I think it was realizing that I had all the skills to take care of myself and my kids. I have a very good relationship with my ex-husband, and I certainly don't take care of them by myself, but I was responsible all of a sudden on my own for half of college tuition and a mortgage on my own and that sort of thing. But it was also this notion that, like many women, and I know this because of the work that I've done recently researching and writing Women with Money, which is my new book. Mm-hmm. The thing that makes us feel safe and secure and in control is saving more. And I supercharged my savings at that point. And just because nothing else made me feel as in control and as independent and as powerful.
Let's shift to that. Let's shift that to your new book. I saw that that had come out, Women with Money. And, you know, you speak to a demographic, to an audience, and statistically, I saw the other day that, and maybe this was you reporting this, that by, I think it was the year 2030, correct me if I'm wrong, but that 2/3 of the country's wealth will be controlled by women. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just that, there are a couple of things going on here. It's educational trends. Mm-hmm. So right now, about 132 women are graduating college for every 100 men. That's wow. The big deal. Yeah. But it's also, we've got a large intergenerational transfer of wealth underway from the baby boomers. Mm-hmm. And women are going to inherit twice. We're going to inherit from our parents, but we're also going to inherit from the husbands that we outlive. And so a lot of money is going to end up in our hands.
Inheriting wealth is one thing, but Gina's really speaking of a huge shift in the distribution and dynamics of wealth within society. And I asked her to share what she felt women needed to hear for them both to be aware and to prepare for this big shift in wealth and the wisdom that should accompany that.
That this bias to safety, although completely understandable and almost innate, can also hold you back. And that we need to be really conscious of making the most of our money, and that means investing it. And the nice thing about that is that a lot of research done mainly by financial services firms has shown women are ready to step up and invest. We want to do this. And when we do it very well. We not only save more than men save in percentage terms, but we do slightly better in terms of the performance on our investments. And so we need to step up and get going because we're still investing, again, in percentage terms, less than men.
So what does that look like on the practical level, Jean? If there are women listeners out there, you know, to this podcast and they say, Jean, I hear you. I want to step it up. I want to invest more. You know, the two things, one of the things you cautioned about was about not letting safety, you know, hold us back. What is one way that you would encourage people to push past that safety to perhaps unlock, you know, greater heights of wealth for themselves?
I'd say first take a very good look at your savings and checking account. Women sometimes have thousands of dollars sitting in savings and checking that should really be in the markets, should really be in a portfolio. The money that you need for the short term, of course, belongs in safekeeping, in the bank where you're not going to lose the down payment for the house that you want to buy or lose the college tuition that has to be paid in the next few years. But money that you do truly not need for years should be in a portfolio. And many of us are already doing it. We're putting money into 401ks and IRAs and SEP IRAs. We just don't exactly consider that investing. And I know that sounds like a weird disconnect, but I've gone out and talked to a lot of groups of women and I'll ask, are you an investor? And very few hands go up. And then I'll ask, do you have a 401k? and all the hands go up. And there's some sort of connecting of the dots that's not going on. I think it's that in our minds, investors are traders. I mean, we tend to think that people who are investors all look and sound like Jim Cramer. And, you know, and the reality is those are traders. They're playing a very different game. And investing is much more long-term. Everybody can succeed. You don't have to be doing hours and hours of research into individual stocks or even individual mutual funds. You can buy the markets as a whole, keep your fees low, and do incredibly well.
So is that the advice that you would give or the wisdom that you would share for women out there who perhaps have too much money in their checking or savings account, need to have that money in the market and just say, hey, you know, a low cost S&P index fund perhaps might be the way for you to go just to let your money work for you?
Yeah, I absolutely would. An index fund, a target date retirement fund. And if you're not sure exactly what to do, a financial plan is a good way to help you step your way there. So if you haven't consulted a planner, if you haven't sat down and said, these are my goals, how do I get there? That's a really good move to make.
So it sounds like being intentional and having a goal is going to be incredibly important for building wealth as you've seen it.
People who have goals are much more successful in actually reaching them.
Mm. So for you at 40, you had this significant mind, you know, set change. You decided, heck, I want to save a lot more. Talk to us from there. What were some of the significant things that happened over the next several years where that mindset began to play itself out and how you went about building wealth? Could you tell us more about that?
Sure. Well, I mean, the first thing that I did was put it on automatic pilot. So for all of my goals, I save automatically, and I've done enough work in and around the field of behavioral finance to know that that helps me. It stops me from making mistakes. It keeps me out of my own way. It prevents the equation from getting too emotional. I save first. People ask, you know, how do you budget? I don't actually have a line by line budget. What I do is have savings goals, and I hit all of those marks. And then essentially, whatever's left over, as long as you're not racking up debt that you have to pay off over time, is fair game. You can choose to manage the rest of those resources as you want. And so I not only save for retirement that way, I save for college with automatic payments. My husband and I are looking at buying another, a next place to live. And, I have been putting money away every single month toward that goal automatically. I've done it for big vacations where I don't want to see credit card bills when I come home. Mm. It's incredibly simple and incredibly helpful. So that's the first thing that I did.
And where do you feel like you learned that? I mean, was it something that just made sense to you after all of your reporting? Was it something that you saw others doing in your reporting? How did you come about that wisdom?
Yeah, I think it was, I mean, I've had the opportunity to talk to the smartest people in finance. And in behavioral finance, but also in different investment firms. Automating is the kind of advice that you hear every single day. I just decided that I was going to do that. I actually think I've had the opportunity, the pleasure of working several times over the course of my career with Jason Zweig, who writes the Intelligent Investor column for the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. Learned a lot from him over the years. And I think Jason actually said, yeah, this is what I do. And I think I thought, well, if it's good enough for Jason's Zweig, it's certainly good enough for me.
So yeah, mimic the best and do what they do. Yeah. No, I think that's a great approach. So, you know, you've automated your savings, you've put it in, you know, you're in the market, you're helping people see that they're investors. Talk to me about some of those goals. What is it like to reach them? I mean, how do you celebrate that? I mean, we've moved on to this place now where as you've been disciplined, you've been consistent, you've automated the savings, you've gotten the market, you've let your money work for you. What do you do once you begin to build some of that wealth? What do you do once you begin to, as you said, you know, you and your husband looking for the next place to live? Are these moments where you guys go out, you reach a goal, you celebrate with a nice dinner? How do you set yourself up to continue to be motivated to be so aggressive in your savings and to pay yourself first?
A little bit of anxiety helps, I think. So, I mean, what we know about, I mean, my savings goals are, I don't want to say never ending, but I will save as long as I am able to work, and I will work as long as I am able, because I get a lot of enjoyment out of what I do. I'm also of the mindset that the road to the goals is the fun part, and achieving the goals is actually a little bit of the letdown. And so yes, absolutely. You want to take some time to enjoy, but I think it's good to have goals, different goals all along the way that will help you stay motivated. And that's always possible because life is always changing.
Well, as you go along and you start to approach those goals and numbers that are in the tens of thousands becoming the hundreds of thousands, how do you make your big decisions, and how do you know what stuff not to worry about?
I generally talk them through with my husband. And when you say what stuff not to worry about, what are you thinking of?
Well, I think that there's certain places where, as you said before, fear can hold us back. Right. And so, there's certain decisions along the way that everything has components, everything has risks. And I think perhaps through repetition, for some folks, they would say they learned what not to worry about and what things to really focus in on. And so I think it's a process of elimination. As we learn what not to worry about, well, then it gives us more time to focus on the big decisions that actually do have to be made. So yeah, does that help answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And I use two different sets of tools. I always am asking what's the worst that can happen. I make a bad decision. What's the worst that can happen? Well, I could back out of it in this way. I could regroup and retrench in this way. When I took the job on Wall Street, I mean, I remember asking, what if I can't get back to journalism? And in my mind, the worst that could happen was that I would become an equity research analyst, a really good one, who would probably make many times the money that I could make as a journalist while doing something that I would probably really enjoy.
Yeah.
So I use that tool. But I also, Susie Welsh, Jack Welsh's wife, Susie, who is a wonderful writer and a columnist for CNBC. I've had a number of conversations with her over the years. She uses a strategy called 10-10-10, okay, where you ask yourself, all right, if I do this, if I don't do this, what happens in 10 weeks? What happens in 10 months? And what happens in 10 years?
Wow. That is a fascinating way to approach a decision. Apply that for us to a decision that you've made or decided not to make, if you would.
Sure. You are faced with, and sometimes it's career challenges, right? You are offered the opportunity to, in my case, to write a book, to give a speech, to moderate a conference. You do it. What happens in 10 weeks, in 10 months, in 10 years, or you say yes to it, what happens? Maybe you're scared to death because you've never done it before in 10 weeks and you're still in the panic that you have to get up on that stage. In 10 months, you've done it and it has either been a good experience or a not so good experience. And 10 years from now, you don't remember whether it was a good experience or a bad experience. All you remember is that you got to interview Michael Phelps from the stage.
Yeah, that's helpful. Yeah, I think it's because it offers perspective, right?
Yeah.
on the decisions that we've made. Would you say perspective is the thing that more folks need when it comes to their finances?
I think it certainly helps. I think I think perspective is what allows people to know that even though the stock markets are incredibly volatile, you should not sell when they have a terrible day or a terrible week or a terrible month. You should make sure that your portfolio is in balance, maybe add some more to it and ride it out. You know, time is, my stepfather says, time and compound interest are your best friends. And he's pretty right about that.
One thing I found during my discussion with Jean is how she approaches life with a very logical, almost mathematical approach and assesses the worst case scenarios and then plans around that. Now, don't get me wrong. She has a fantastically positive and pragmatic perspective on what she wants the outcome to be, but hope for the best and plan for the worst is something that Jean has actualized in her life. I asked what practical advice she had for anyone to be able to live and to succeed in their own lives.
Two things. I think you need to know what you're good at. Sometimes I say you have to know your superpower. My superpower is being able to communicate about a subject that people find daunting in language that they can understand. That's what gets me hired. And it gets me hired every single time. You need to know what you're good at. And then you need to be not shy about embracing the fact that you're really good at that. That would be one thing. And the other thing that's helped me is that I have forced myself to be brave enough to walk through doors as they open. When I am presented with an opportunity, I have a bias toward yes. And I think that's important too.
Bravery and self-awareness. I think those are two huge pieces of wisdom for folks that want to build their wealth. Jean, where can our listeners find out more about you, about what you teach, about what you speak on, and about the some of the great books that you've written?
I'd love it if they would go to hermoney.com/subscribe. That'll get them to my podcast, Her Money. It'll get them to my new book. It'll get them to our Her Money newsletter, which we publish twice a week, and everything else that we're working on.
Great. Well, Jean Chatsky, thank you so much for your time, for the wisdom you shared with our audience. And we really appreciate it. And we hope you have a great day.
I hope you do too. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Some great wisdom in there. Loved hearing your story and, think that so many folks will benefit from it. So keep doing what you're doing. I think your message is spot on and more folks need to hear about it.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
Well, that's a wrap for this episode. Thanks for listening. I invite you to visit RagingBull.com/podcast. That's RagingBull.com/podcast to discover more episodes and to learn more about people who have created, built, and lived successful lives. Also, remember to subscribe to one of Raging Bull's newsletters. Join me on the next episode as we share more stories from our guests on the wisdom behind wealth and how they built their own success. Raging Bull Podcast is brought to you by RagingBull.com, helping traders succeed through education, resources, and where you can watch real traders make trades. Raging Bull, learn to trade. We'll show you how.